For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
I feel like I'm invading some private club when I come and speak on Monday nights, because you're here every week, or regularly, I should say, and I'm not here that regularly. So, welcome to me. It's great to be with you. It's great to be here. It's an elite group. Tonight's installment of Essentials is dedicated by Dr. Stan and Sharon Harris in celebration of their Chai anniversary. May you have many, many more at Me'av Ezrim. And also, and we will separate by the word also, in memory of Shlomo Muradov, who just passed this past Shabbos, Shlomo Baruch ben Binyamin HaKohen, who was just buried today in Eretz Yisrael. May his memory be a blessing. What you have in front of you is an outline, which we will more or less follow. And you have a kind of a verbal map of the soul, which we're not going to cover tonight. But I thought it would be useful for you to have this. And the last two pages in the small handout that you have will describe some of the technology of the soul. And you can look through that at your own leisure and appreciate what you can and not appreciate what you can't. And I don't mean to insult you by saying that. It's the literature itself states that you can't appreciate it. But it's worth knowing that it exists. Okay, so we're going to talk about the soul tonight. So before we begin, let me ask for an informal show of hands. How many of you believe that you have a soul? Wow. Okay, that's pretty impressive. And I'll tell you why that's impressive. It's not impressive because you are believers and you're in an Orthodox synagogue. It's actually impressive because you don't have a soul. You do not have a soul. Who agrees with that? By a show of hands. Yes. Can you tell me why you agree with the fact that you don't have a soul?
No, this is prior knowledge. Because you said that we are a soul covered by the Torah, which is a body.
Woo, excellent. Okay, that's it. The class is over. So, because you don't have a soul any more than you don't have an existence. You don't have that. You are that. You exist. And you are a soul. And Judaism would say that you have a body, right? Which means that you exist primarily as a soul. We'll use the word neshama now. And as an attachment or an adage or some kind of an associated partner, you, the soul, have a body. So then in that sense, you don't have a soul, you are a soul, you are a neshama. And there are many implications to that. We're going to talk about that tonight, what all the implications are. We've tried to first demonstrate how do we know that the we are really an essential aspect. How do we know that the essential aspect of ourselves is called the soul? And what is it? And is the soul, how does the soul work with the body? Is it in conflict with the body? Does it help the body? Does the body help the soul? Why does it relate to the body the way it does? We're going to talk about that. And what about the body? We said we're talking about body and soul. So are we going to give the body its due? Does the body get credit for any existence? Is it important? Do we wish we didn't have to deal with it? What's our relationship with our body? And what's the purpose? What's the purpose of having a soul? What's the purpose of being a soul, I should say? So let me read to you something that is adopted from Arya Kaplan. Many of you probably have something by Arya Kaplan in your libraries at home. He was a prolific writer, a man who died very young, as a matter of fact. Amazing what he accomplished in less than 40 years in life. And he writes like this, and I've adjusted it a little bit. He says, look at your hand. Are you looking at your hand? Anybody doing that? What do you see? a part of your body, an appendage made of bone and sinew, covered with flesh and skin. It's filled with nerves, blood vessels, and lymph ducts, which run through it and connect it to your body, making it part of you. You can open and close your hand. It obeys every command that your mind sends to it. It's yours, a part of you. But what are you? Who is the real you? What happens when you tell your hand to open and close? How does your mind will it to obey its commands? Now point a finger at yourself. If you're an average person, you'll point a finger at your chest. Most people don't point a finger at their earlobe. Point a finger at yourself, they don't go, here I am, right? Okay, you think of yourself as your body. But is your body the real you? Not long ago, a person could consider his own body an integral part of himself. You were your body, and your body was you. But this is no longer the case. Scientific progress has changed the entire concept of human personality and identity. For example, heart transplants are now an almost commonplace occurrence. They don't even make the news anymore. A man can live with another person's heart beating in his breast. If we would ask such a man to point to himself, would he point to his heart? Is this transplanted heart really part of him? Is the heart that beats within your breast the real you? Or is it something else entirely? The real you is not your body or brain, but the information contained in your brain. Your memories, personality traits, and thought patterns. A great Shabbos table discussion would be, what would happen if you'd have a brain transplant? Would you be the body or would you be the brain? It's a fascinating discussion. You think you know, but you don't. Okay? Just think about it a little bit. So what happens then when a person dies? We're not going to be spending a lot of time on that tonight at all, but that by talking a little bit about death, we'll understand about life. We know that the body ceases to function, the brain becomes inert, the physical man is dead, but what happens to the real you, the human personality? What happens to all this information, the memories, thought patterns, personality traits? When a book is burned, its contents no longer exist. When a computer is smashed, the information within is also destroyed. Does the same thing happen when a man dies? Is the mind and personality irretrievably lost? We know that God is omniscient. He knows all and doesn't forget. God knows every thought and memory that exists within our brains. There's no bit of information that escapes his awareness and knowledge. So what is it that happens when a person dies? The Bible speaks of immortality of the soul in Mishle. The dust returns to the dust as it were, but the spirit returns to God who gave it. The Ha'afar Tashuv. Ha'afar, V'haruach, and the spirit goes back to God who gave it. That means that there is a part of a man that is eternal, that lives beyond the lifetime of the physical body. God created human beings as composite creatures, consisting of a physical body and a spiritual soul. Both of these parts of a person are creatures of God. The difference between them is that the body withers and dies, while the soul lives on forever, housing a person's consciousness and his identity. So we're made up of a body and soul, and the combined experience is what we call being alive in this world. And when a person perishes physically, the soul continues to exist. And that's why we have so many rituals, of course, Kaddish, Tzedakah, other mitzvahs that are performed for the deceased, because there's something there, and it's not the body. And the soul really is the home of the person's identity and his own true self. So you have Chumashim in front of you, and I want to move to the creation of man, because everything that we really know about man is described in the Torah, even if we may not see it all on the surface. So please take out your Chumash, and we're going to learn a little Chumash together. And we're going to open to page 8, chapter 1. Well, let's see. let's do that. Okay. All right, make it page 6 if you don't mind. Go back one page. Chapter 1, we're looking at let's start with verse 24. This is the beginning of what we know to be the sixth day of creation, of Friday. Everybody with me? Okay. So I'm going to be going very quickly because we're not going to be studying this passage by passage. If there's anything that catches your eye that you think is relevant or important that we have to stop on, please just raise your hand or yell out, bang on the table, or spill your water, and we'll notice. Okay, so whatever it takes to get our attention. So verse 24, God said, let the earth put forth living creatures according to their kind, behema, remes, chaisoi eretz lemina, animals, creeping things, beasts of the land, each according to its kind. Fine. Not necessarily. Nefesh, what do you mean? Because you're saying...
If you read without the word nefesh, now that you're pointing out that sentence, the word nefesh seems unnecessary.
Very good. So we're going to have to conclude that nefesh actually is a life force that exists even in beasts, right? Whatever it is. We're going to have to conclude that it's something that's not unique to a human being, right? Whatever it is, I'm avoiding defining what it is, but whatever it is, it's not unique to a human being. It's something having to do with a life force. Anyway, so God did that, right? God said, "Let that happen," and then God made that. And then the important thing here in verse 25 at the very end, "Vayar Elokim ki tov," God saw that it was good. That's a refrain that we're very familiar with in Bereishis. And it occurs almost after almost every invention or creation of the Almighty. And here God sees that it's good. So I'll point out right now that after he calls forth man, on the next page, turn the page, just point out, it doesn't say anywhere that God saw it was good. And at this point, we're kind of addicted to that. It's kind of like, you know, poetry. Every day, and Yara Lakim Kitov, God saw that it was good. All of a sudden, man comes forth, his crowning achievement. And it doesn't say, Vayar Elokim ki tov, God saw that it was good. Only at the very end it says, God saw all that he made, and it was tov ma'od. And that includes everything, but not man. There's no special thing about man. And what we would have to say is that it's not true. God did not see that it was good. You know why? Because man is either good or not good. Man, among all the creatures of God's world, could either be good or not. Therefore, God did not see that it was good. Everything else has no choice but to be whatever it is. Man has a choice about what he's going to be. And that's going to be important. Okay, verse 26. God said, you know what? Before we do that, you don't have to turn the page. This one everybody knows. Bereishis bara Elokim. In the beginning, let's translate it the easy way. It's not necessarily the only way, and it may not even be the right way, but let's just use it this way. Bereishis bara Elokim. In the beginning, God created es hashamayim ve'es ha'aretz, the heaven and the earth. That passage is a very, very important passage, because that passage says that God created not only the physical universe, but also created the spiritual universe. That opening sentence is a major declaration in the face of other belief systems that say that the physical universe and the spiritual universe are not of the same source. And right away at the opening shot of the Torah, the first thing the Torah says is, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And therefore, even spirituality is a creation of God. It's a very important concept that we sometimes have a hard time with. We sometimes think that spirituality is something that just happens around God or associated with God. But the idea of a spirit or the idea of a spiritual realm, of a plane or a realm in which spirituality as a real existence, as a force, as a reality exists, that is called forth by God. Spirituality is not something that happens when you think about God. It's a realm that God creates. God created heaven and earth. That's the beginning. That sentence, by the way, sets the tone for everything in Jewish thought. Because as we're going to see coming up, unity is the whole goal of the existence of a human being, to declare the unity of God, to see everything in the world, good, bad, physical, spiritual, right, wrong, everything emanates from the Almighty. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, one. We hope to die with that word, one, right? That's a privilege for a Jew to end his life saying that sentence, because that's the point of existence. So God is the author of spirituality, of the spiritual realm as well as the physical realm. Okay, I'm saying that for a reason, because we now know, before we've gotten into creation, that the source of all spirituality is the Almighty. Now, verse 26, God said, Nasa Adam Tzamenu Kedmetzenu, let's make man in our image, in our likeness. We're not going to go into the nuances of what's the difference between image and likeness, but it's going to be like us. We're going to make this thing, this creature called Adam, and it's going to be like us. The us, we're also going to ignore right now, let's just accept that he's talking to the angels, and God is now talking, therefore, to spiritual creatures, and he's saying, let's do this, right? Like Home Depot, let's do this. Let's make Adam b'tzalmenu kidmusenu, in our image. Why? Why? What do we know as soon as we see that God says, let's make it like us, resemble us in our image, whatever it is, something similar to us. What do we know if he's saying that? It's going to be somebody who's going to be capable of... Very good. So I'm sidestepping that. The sages say that that means he's talking to the angels and consulting with them, teaching us a lesson that when you make a big move, you should always consult and not do it all by yourself. You should learn how to consult with other people, even people who know less than you. All right, there's a lot to talk about there, but that's not going to be germane to our conversation now. Yes? We're supposed to, right, so the idea of our likeness, similar to us, is that we're going to create a creature that's going to have similar characteristics to us, which means that it's going to be capable of relationship, right? You cannot relate to some being with which you have nothing in common. So immediately we know we're talking about a relationship creature here. Let's make man in our image, and he will rule over all this stuff. Okay. And God creates man in his image, male and female. He blesses them, tells them, be fruitful, multiply, conquer. And he says, I've given you everything to eat. Everything's for you to eat. God saw everything that he did. It's good. Okay. And that's it. It's over. Sixth day is finished. And then the next paragraph is Shabbos. Really amazing. The next paragraph is Shabbos. Because... the whole point of Shabbos is that there be an availability in the physical world that God is creating, an availability of connection to the source of that world. And therefore, part of creation is Shabbos. It's not that creation is over, but God creates the concept that in the physical world you can have access to the spiritual world through this bridge called Shabbos. And of course, man has to be there in order to be able to have the consciousness for there to be a creature in the world that reigns over the world, that's able to then bring that world through the bridge of Shabbos and all that it represents to the heaven, so to speak. So the heaven and earth are all finished and all their hosts, and God has Shabbos. Fine. Now, let's look at there are different titles for the next paragraph. Verse 4. This is going to be the second version, so to speak, of creation. And when we say second version, we don't mean contradictory. We just mean a different description, additional information. So these are the chronicles of heaven and earth. Is that how they translate it here? These are the products. Okay. These are the chronicles or products of heaven and earth when they were created on the day that God made heaven and earth. Let's move on, skip the next few passages that describe the state of affairs in the world. There was a mist, things hadn't grown yet. And verse 7, God formed man, earth from the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a nefesh chaya, a living creature. And we know that the famous translation of Targum Onkelos, the Aramaic translation, you see it here on the page, he translates Nefesh Chaya as Ruach Mamalala. A Ruach Mamalala means a speaking spirit, a speaking spirit. Yes? Female, yeah.
So the initial creation before Shabbos is of the soul, and the creation later is of the
body. Interesting. You're assuming that this paragraph, which appears after the description of Shabbos, is describing events after Shabbos. I don't know if that's a safe assumption. I hear the point. I hear what you're suggesting, but I don't think that's a safe assumption. This is really, in a certain sense, the Torah going back and doing another flyover.
So it's meant to be continuous.
Parallel. But you're still making a very interesting observation. Let's just, for our purposes, say that in our image and in our likeness doesn't mean carbon copy. It means similar dimensions. By the way, the single most common characteristic that man has with God is something that you and I exercise zillions of times a minute, which is initiative, free choice, creativity, right? We are the only creatures in God's world that actually choose what we do, right? Nobody else chooses. It looks like they choose. They don't choose, all right? No dog ever said that I'd like to live a different kind of a life. I'd like to upgrade my status, right? It goes on and on. So, as a matter of fact, we take animals to doctors if they do anything different than all the other animals of its species, right? Because that means it's got a psychiatric problem. So, notice that bear in the Bronx Zoo that swam back and forth on its side, they took it to a bear doctor because bears don't do that and you can't choose that. So human beings are the only ones. But choice is it. Now this is really important. Choice is the thing that makes us similar to God more than anything else. We are godly because we initiate. We have choice. Okay, so now God breathes the breath of life. Unkelus translates this being as a nefesh chaya, the same phrase that you noticed before. Unkelus here translates it differently. Why does he translate it differently? Because there's a distinct feature of man that doesn't apply to any other living creature, including breathing animals, and that is speech. So Unkelus chooses to define man as a spirit that speaks, ruach mamalala. And that is a very that means that the neshama of the Almighty, the breath of God, breathed into the nostrils of man, is what causes man to speak, right? That's how the passage would read. He breathed into his nostrils the neshama of Chaim, the breath of life, and man became a speaking creature. And so speech itself is the expression of the neshama. There was a question back there? Jennifer. Yeah. Okay, great question. Make sure I address that. Okay, where do you get personality? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, what makes me me? Right. Okay. Good. That's a very important question. It should develop as we go along. Hold me to it. Okay. Now let's go a little fast here. It's always dangerous when you look at text because it's so juicy. But so God planted a garden in Eden toward the east, and He placed man there. And there's all kinds of great fruit, and there's rivers going very fast. And God commands man, saying, from all the trees of the garden, verse 16, 17, eat. But from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, don't eat, because the day you eat from there, you'll die. Okay, so the first thing that comes to mind is, since we know this story, and we know he's going to eat, and we know he doesn't die, how could it be that God said the day you eat from there, you're going to die? And the short answer is that he did die, because if life is being connected to the source, death is being disconnected from the source. So the point is that the day you eat from there, you will have violated what I said, you will have violated your mission. I gave you one mission, and now you're disconnected. And therefore, that's the beginning of death. That's what death is. And life is actually reflecting the source of existence. And that's why when God breathes into man, he's alive. So now what does God do? He gives him a mitzvah. So immediately that means that he's communicating with a creature, and he's telling the creature what to do, and he's holding the creature accountable, which means that the creature has choice. Now, what is that choice built on? What would have him listen to God? What would have him not listen to God? Right? That's a good question. But that's going to reflect the dual nature of man, the duality that exists in man, the struggle that God creates. Till God says, don't eat from the tree of knowledge, man has no problems. He's got a garden, and he's got food. And God doesn't say anything. The moment God says, don't eat from that tree, now man has a problem. He's got to either listen or not listen, and he's going to have a reason to listen, and he's going to have a reason not to listen. And it's going to go on, and he won't be able to sleep at night till he resolves it. And it'll go on forever. And that's what we're struggling with right now. Should we or shouldn't we do what we should or what we shouldn't? And this is exactly the point. The issuance of a mitzvah immediately creates a dilemma. God says, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helpmate opposite him. And he makes Eve. A lot to talk about here, but that's not what we're here for now. So, then the Torah says in verse 25, let's go to verse 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his mother and his father and cling to his wife, and they'll be one flesh. Very interesting. The passage chooses to put that in it over here. I recall that I found it actually thanks to Google, a quote from Aristotle, who says that love is composed of a single soul inhabiting two bodies. Right? So therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, cling to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So this is more than just a fleshy connection. This is very much a spiritual connection. And this is because of humans' capacity to share, so to speak, in a soul. Because one of the dimensions of a soul, and this is important, one of the dimensions of a soul is it is a connection device. The point of a soul is a device for connection. They were both naked, and they were not ashamed. What is the Torah saying with that? They could not conceive of a way of abusing their nakedness. It meant nothing other than they existed. There was nothing that they saw in each other that could cause them to in any way think of anything negative. And therefore, they were not ashamed. The serpent entices them to eat. They eat. And now they're in trouble. And again, this is an awful way to go through this chapter. But for our purposes, it's going to have to suffice. And they get consequences. Okay, so they're held accountable. And then the Torah records at the last sentence of this narrative, verse 21 on page 18, after all of the consequences that are meted out to the serpent, to Chava, to Adam, it says, "Vayas Hashem Elokim la'Adam alishto kasnas or vayavishem." God made for Adam and his wife garments of leather, and he gave it to them to wear. Is that right? I'm looking for verse 21 on page 18. And God made for Adam and his wife garments of skin, and he clothed them. Okay, so the Gemara relates that in Rabbi Meir's Torah, this raises other questions, but the Gemara relates that in Rabbi Meir's Torah, where it says the word or, which is ayin vav rech, which means skin or hide, in his Torah it said aleph vav rech, which is light, right? So now, as soon as the Gemara says that, the Gemara is now telling us that there is something in this particular word and in the act of giving them some form of clothing or garment or vestment or covering that has to do with the issue of light. Isn't it interesting that the word for skin or hide in Hebrew, or, is the same exact spelling as the word blind. Ayin vav resh. Iver is a blind person. Ayin vav resh or is skin. Why? Because the skin is designed to cover something under it. That's the whole point. And therefore you can't see. You can't see this through the skin. Actually, you could, because there are pores. So the skin does a pretty good job of covering what's underneath. But if you get really good at it, you can look through and you can see under the skin. So Rabbi Meir's Torah says he made them garments of light. Whatever that means in terms of the technicalities of a Torah scroll with different letters, that's another story. But Rabbi Meir was seeing here that ultimately they would be creatures who could project light. And in the verse that we have, in the version that we have, the light was covered over. So this indicates that once, in other words, before the sin, they had not been capable of conceiving, of doing something inappropriate with themselves. And it's possible even that then what they were luminaries. They were just like light. Maybe they had some kind of a faint body, but maybe they were in essence, the neshama. They were in essence a soul interacting. They had some kind of a physical existence because they're in this physical world. And they saw each other and lo yisbashasha because they weren't embarrassed because they saw their essence. They saw through the superficial. And they didn't see themselves as physical beings. Once they eat from the tree of knowledge and they violate God's will and they detach from their source and they become more physical creatures, now they've got something to cover up and their skin itself is now the more apparent thing and makes it more difficult to see their light, to see their neshama, to see their radiant light, the breath of life itself. And so I'm just pointing out in this clothing that God gives them, there's this hint at the light that is underneath. There's an awareness that the physical covers and causes you to be blind to the physical, to the spiritual. And there's an awareness that in our essence, we were originally spiritual creatures with some tint, a tinge of physicality. What's interesting, what I see in this is fascinating, is that there's a parallel play on words that I think references the same kind of duality. And that is the word for world. What's the word in Hebrew, for world? Olam. Olam. Olam means world. We have Olam Hazeh, we have Olam Haba, we have Olam, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, King of the Universe, Olam. Do you know, what's the word for hidden? Yes, He'olam, He'olam. The same root, Ayin, Lamed, Mem, Olam, world, Ne'olam is disappeared or hidden, right? Because the world itself is a cover for reality. What you see in the world is not the essence of the world. The world that we're looking at fools us into thinking that what we see is all there is. The goal of existence is to see beyond the hidden. So for example, do you see God anywhere? I don't see God anywhere. I work hard and then I see through the veil of the world itself. But the world itself doesn't show me God. He's not apparent. He's ne'elam. So therefore the world is called olam because it's a device created by God to hide his existence so that we can then work to see it. So I'm saying in the human being, in the essence of a human being, and in the world itself, we have this dual nature. There's the life of the world, which is God himself, and there's the life of a human, which is the neshama. There's the ability to see, there's the superficial covering over the neshama, which is the physical thing, which is the aura, which causes blindness because it blinds you to the essence of a person. But there's also the desire to see through that and an attempt and mechanisms through which we see through that. And the same thing in the world itself. Okay, so this is, by way of introduction, here we see where the Torah itself says that a human being is endowed with a soul. Now, Rashi points out, by the way, a very interesting point, that when it says when it says that he breathed into him the breath of life, God says, "As o min ha'elyonim u min ha'tachtonim guf." He made him. He made God a man from the upper world and from the lower world. Guf from the lower world, a physical body, and neshama from the upper world. Now, what's the significance of that? Rashi borrows this from a medrash that says, on the first day there was the creation of heaven. That was spiritual. On the second day, there was just the creation of earth. On the third day, there were more things created heavenly. On the fourth day, there were things that were created physical. So the first 6 days, there's spiritual, physical, spiritual, physical. Then, if man had been too spiritual, it would have tipped the balance the wrong way. So to retain the balance, God creates him from min ha'elyonim u min ha'tachtonim, from both, so that the balance is maintained. The point is that there's this internal struggle. There's a dichotomy in a human being, and that really creates the opportunity for human beings to make choices. Okay, so let's move on, so to speak, to the question of whether or not this body is against the soul or not. Meaning that we say that a human being has two different components, this physicality. We saw the struggle in the Garden of Eden. Is the body really moving against the soul or not? So, the answer is yes and no. The answer is that the body can be an opponent of the soul, but it doesn't have to be. But God creates man in a condition where he actually has to make choices. And the truth is that the choices that man, the mechanism that makes man subject to making choices is the mechanism of the challenge of the needs of the body with the challenge of the needs of the soul. So why did God create man in such a condition? What's the whole point here? So one point is exactly what we said before. Man actually gets to create him or herself. When I say himself, I mean the human species. Please forgive me. I won't do that every time. When man actually gets to create himself, what does that mean? In other words, when God creates the opportunity for a human being to make choices, God is saying, you are not complete when I put you into the world. You're actually going to be your own creator. And you're going to be your own creator by exercising choice. And you will make of yourself what you choose to make of yourself. The ultimate responsibility is for a person not just to cause things in the world, but to cause himself in the world. Right? In other words, what I do actually makes me. So that I'm not just an action machine, I'm not just a doer, I'm a becomer. And I'm a becomer either of good or of evil, but I get to choose. In the endowing man with choice, God is actually creating out of man the ultimate creator of himself. So that's one purpose of putting the body and the soul in the same creature and having the body work to some degree against the soul. There's another purpose. The Ramchal says, Rav Moshe Chaim Lotzato says, that the purpose of the struggle is actually to give man the opportunity to earn his portion in the world to come. Meaning to overcome something and thereby to win his portion in the world to come. So let me share something with you and see if you can guess who said this. Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, ambition inspired, and success achieved. Does anybody know who said that? I didn't know either before today. Yes? Close. Meaning he was a guy. It was a guy who said it, but that's as close as he got. Helen Keller said that. So when the Ramchal says that God created this duality in order for us to have this struggle to be able to earn Olam Haba, he's not just talking about he wants us to get prizes. What he's talking about is Olam Haba is nothing other than a than an intimate relationship with the Almighty that can only be realized in a world designed specifically for ultimate connection to God. And therefore, he creates this being that has this struggle. The struggle itself was what refines character to the point where the person actually becomes a spiritually dominant person, if it works out well. If it works out well. Now, you may, I think last week, Rabbi Freundlich talked about Olam Haba a little bit, or life after death. So there's a major discussion about the exact nature of existence in Olam Haba. Let's just say that whether we agree that there'll be a body or not, even if there's not going to be a body, what it means is that it won't be a body of great significance. It'll be just enough to somehow pin down the soul. But the individual soul will bask in the closeness to the Almighty as a result of what was accomplished in this world. To the degree that a body perseveres in its desires over the neshama, to that degree, the neshama in Olam Haba is a little weaker. It's a 30-watt bulb instead of a 60-watt bulb. Right, and therefore it doesn't, because that's what was created in this world. What the person created out of himself was somebody who was a little bit more given to the body than to the soul. To the degree that the soul is dominant, then that soul illuminates tremendously and has a much more powerful kind of radiance in Olam Haba. But the idea is for the struggle to ensue in this world, Olam Hazeh, and that's the goal. The goal is the struggle. And that's why it's a uniquely Jewish idea. That's why we always kibitz about Jews have to suffer. So in a certain sense, it's true. Which means we actually believe that we're created in this world to engage in a struggle. Not with evil, but a struggle with ourselves. A struggle with a part of ourselves that wants us to live for now, to live for comfort, to live for ease, to live for earthliness, to live for pleasure. Versus the part of ourselves that wants to live for eternity, that wants to live for connection, that wants to live for transcendence, for purpose, for meaning, and therefore doesn't necessarily look for, doesn't even value comfort, because comfort has no value to the soul. So that's one of the major reasons that this dichotomy is created in a human being. And in a certain sense, the body does work against the soul, and that's a good thing. That struggle is what Helen Keller was talking about in her way, what the Ramchal Lahavdil or Moshe Chaim Lotzato is talking about in his way. What causes a person to be able to grow and to be able to create out of himself a spiritual creature. Okay. Now the fact is that the body complements the soul as well. Let me quote you the famous Gemara in Sanhedrin, where Antoninus says to Rebbe. Rebbe and Antoninus have this famous relationship. They're both very wealthy. They're both leaders, major leaders. He, a Roman leader, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the author, the editor of the Mishnah. So Antoninus says to Rebbe, the body and soul can exempt each other in the heavenly judgment. When they get up to heaven, both the body and the soul can get out of any condemnation. How so? The body can say, it was the soul that's responsible for transgression. For since the day that it separated from me, I've been lying in the grave like inert stone. I haven't done anything. The soul can say, it was the body that transgressed. Since the day that I separated from it, I've been soaring in the air like a bird. And I'm not even capable of sinning. So Antoninus said to Rabbi, how can anybody be held accountable? Each part of the being will weasel out of it. So Rabbi said to him, I'll give you an analogy. This is like the case of a human king who had a beautiful orchard with delectable fruit. He placed two guards in the orchard, one lame and one blind. The lame one said to the blind one, I see beautiful fruit in the orchard. Come and place me on your shoulders. We'll get some and eat it. The lame man rode on the blind man's shoulders and they fetched the fruits and ate them. Eventually, the owner of the orchard came and said, where are my beautiful fruits? The lame man said, do I have legs to walk with? The blind man said, do I have eyes to see? The owner immediately placed the lame man on the shoulders of the blind man and judged them as one. Similarly, the Holy One, blessed be He, will bring the soul and cast it into the body and judge them together. It's really important. So it's not. It sounds almost like a parable that you can read to a kindergarten class, right? You know, cute, you get a little question, and then, But it's much more profound than that. Antoninus is saying to Rebbe, I don't buy this idea, this unity, that the body and the soul are merged together into one entity. I don't buy that at all. I don't believe that physicality and spirituality can exist in the same world. Either there's spirituality or there's physicality. And I would even extend that and say, I would put it in words in his mouth and say, physicality by definition is all bad. There's nothing good about it. And therefore it can't possibly coexist with the spirit. And therefore each one can independently separate itself and get out of any indictment. Rebbe's answer is you don't get it. The Almighty is the source of both. And therefore the Almighty can create a creature that can actually work together. And the body and the soul don't have to be enemies. And they don't have to be... And they can actually work in tandem with each other. And therefore God rewards the merger of the two. The reward and punishment that is meted out to a person is to the entity that created the reality of the relationship that they have with God, and that's the body and the soul together. So Antoninus is really challenging the whole concept of unity in creation itself, which is ultimately I don't want to distract you now. We won't get into that. I was going to blame another religion for that view. But let me give you another quote from Michelangelo, which really says something very profound. I don't know if Michelangelo knew what he meant himself. I assume he did. Says Michelangelo, "My soul can find no staircase to heaven unless it be through earth's loveliness." Again, "My soul can find no staircase to heaven unless it be through earth's loveliness." It's a beautiful quote. What he's saying is that he sees the Creator in the physical universe, which is, he's not willing to look at physicality as divorced from spirituality. He's not willing to look at a physical universe and see that as somehow emanating from somewhere else. Just the opposite. He sees it all as coming from one. And this is really the idea of the merger of the body and the soul. So the body can be a complement to the soul, or it can be a challenge to the soul. But the struggle itself is what's desired. Now, talking about the body, let's give the body its due. I want to give you a few sources, some of which we're familiar with, some we're not. First of all, Maimonides in the Laws of Deos, which we can translate as character traits or the laws of behavior, at the very beginning of his 14 law books, he codifies the following, chapter 3, paragraph 3. Here's a quote. "A person should ensure that his body is complete and strong so that his soul will be adequately fit to know God, because it is impossible to understand and fathom wisdom when a person is hungry, sick, or if one of his limbs is in pain. Rather, his body should be complete and strong to serve God. And even when he's sleeping, a person should have the intention that he's allowing his mind and body to rest in order that he should not become sick, which would prevent him from serving God. Thus, his sleep becomes part of his service to God. Sheino shelo avodah l'makom baruch hu." His sleep is service, is avodah, is service to God above. Now, every Friday night, if you sing the traditional Zmiros, some of you may know this niggun, some of you don't, and even if you do, you might not recognize it because I'm not known as one of the most evocative singers in the world. But you know the song, I forgot how it starts. Oh, one second, we'll get it. Oh, I can't believe the beginning. I can't remember the beginning. But anyway, you get to the part where it goes real fast and it goes, okay, you know what that is? You can have 30 people sitting around the table and they're talking about stuffed chickens. Okay? Here's the translation. "From the day before we prepare all types of delicacies. While it's still daytime, fattened poultry are prepared. The table is set with different types of foods. We drink aromatic wines, delectable sweets at all three meals, enjoy pleasures, fattened birds, quails and fish." And that's the refrain. We sing that and everybody's sitting there banging on the table at the holy Friday night Shabbos meal. Why? Because it is. Because there's absolutely nothing wrong. Just the opposite. We view all of physicality as access to spirituality if it's used properly, if it's used in the right context. If it's not, if it's for physicality's sake, then it's considered abuse of the physical universe. It's misuse. But if we use it for connection, for enjoyment, for connecting to each other, for enjoying God's world, for realizing that this is reserved for a special day, for helping us relate to the nature of the day itself, then the physicality itself becomes very special. So certainly, we are not an aesthetic religion that believes in ignoring the needs of the body. As a matter of fact, let's go straight into the next source. We're familiar, there's one of the 613 commandments in the Torah is what? Nazir. What's a Nazirite? Nazirite is somebody who takes upon himself a vow to be a Nazir, and he follows the formula that the Torah describes. What does he do? He can't cut his hair, can't have any wine, or anything having to do with the wine. At the end of that 30-day period, he goes through many different rituals. One of the things he does is he brings a sin offering. So the question is, what is he bringing a sin offering for? This is like a holy guy. He's living 30 days, separating from the physical universe. He's doing this probably to repent. The Talmud records one person repented because he once knelt by a spring and he saw an image of his face and he was so handsome, he got all excited because he looked so beautiful, and then he realized he's got a spiritual defect that he's so excited that he looks so nice, so he took upon himself a Nazirite vow to improve his spirituality, as an example, right? So that's what a Nazirite is, a Nazir. He brings a sin offering at the end. So some people say the sin offering is in response to the sin that stimulated him becoming a Nazir in the first place. But most understand that the sin offering is, and the sages say this, for becoming a Nazirite. Even though the Torah describes it as a mitzvah, because that's not the best way to elevate yourself. By depriving yourself of physicality and separating yourself from the world, that's not God's idea of how to become holy. God wants you to become holy by living in the world and transcending the world, not by pushing it away and banning yourself. As they say, for example, when a person wants to repent, it's easier to fast 40 days in a row, eating at night, it's easier to fast 40 days in a row than it is to eat less for 40 days in a row, right? Every day eating only a little bit or half of what's on your plate. Because so therefore, the idea is that a Nazir is not viewed as the highest form of spirituality. Rabbi Wein likes to say that he makes sure to tour the world because he says, what happens when I get up there and God says to me, Beryl, how'd you like my Alps? You know, that's so he doesn't want to say, I was too busy learning to enjoy your world, right? The point is that he understands that the Alps were there also to connect you to God. Okay. What time is it? How much time do we have?
10:07.
Good. Okay. We're on schedule.
If we're yes. supposed to enjoy everything, why aren't we forbidden to eat things?
So that we can have choice. That's exactly the point. That's the model of the Garden of Eden. Eat everything, but just don't eat this tree, right? Which then puts you in the driver's seat. If I say eat everything, then all the food becomes the driver. The existence of the food causes me to eat. As soon as God gives me an opportunity not to eat something because of a command, then I'm choosing what I eat and what I don't eat. That puts me in the driver's seat, right? So he creates choice so that I am now the initiator. By the way, that works not only with food, it works with sex, and it works with time, or the basic commodities. That's really what Kedusha is. Sanctity is putting a human being in the position of using commodities as opposed to the commodities using him. Anyway, okay. Now, that question actually leads into what we're about to talk about, which is accommodating. We're looking at the Roman numeral 2c, accommodating the body while resisting its pull. That's the whole world of Mussar, which itself derives from the idea that a human being, by exercising control and discipline, can actually at once serve the body and also transcend the body. So that the body is there to be used, to be fed, and pleasure is there actually to be had in proper measure as if in a disciplined structure. Some of the sources quote a very interesting mitzvah. Erev Pesach, you're not allowed to eat a serious meal in the afternoon. Okay, we all know this anyway. How many people here had borscht and sour cream when they grew up? Okay, good. Okay, I knew we didn't come up with it ourselves. Anyway, my wife did not grow up with borscht and sour cream on Erev Pesach, and one day after we're married, I said, "Where's the sour cream?" And she said, "What?" And I said, "You mean you didn't do borscht and sour cream your whole life? I thought it was like a mitzvah." But the point is, there's never a decent meal Erev Pesach. Why? So the housewife will say, "Because I'm working for the last week and a half to make a beautiful Seder, and I don't want you filling up beforehand." But the halacha says, because we want you to be hungry when you eat the matzah. Right? We want you to be hungry when you eat the matzah. The first matzah. So, the idea here, say the authorities, is that you can't have a mitzvah to eat if you're not enjoying it. Because eating is enjoying it. You have to have a desire to absorb the thing you're eating in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of eating, because if you're not enjoying it, you're not eating. You're just putting stuff in a cavity in your mouth and then forcing it down into a bigger cavity above your waist. The point, though, is that you're supposed to actually... Eating involves enjoying. If the Torah gives us a mitzvah to eat, it means the Torah says, enjoy this. The point is that the Torah wants us to use all of our physical faculties to serve the Almighty, including the faculty of enjoyment. And so... But we have to use discipline at the same time. So the point is that with discipline, we actually can transcend the body without negating the body. Okay. Now let's talk about what the implications are of being a soul. I would say there are three things that are brought out by the fact that we know that we're a soul. Meaning, not that we agree that we have a soul. Agreeing that we have a soul or that we are a soul that has a body, agreeing is not the goal. The goal in Jewish life is actually to know that we are a soul, the way that a person who's married for 40 years wakes up one day and doesn't say, "Am I married or am I not?" "Oh, I'm married." Right? The person is governed by a consciousness that says, "I'm married." Or a person doesn't have to check in every day and say, "Am I male or female?" You just are, right? And you know you are, but you don't know you know you are because you don't have to think about it. It's just real. That's the kind of knowing and awareness that is the goal. So when a person actually knows him herself to be a soul in that level, there are major implications to how you deal with life. So one is, as we said before, that all of a sudden the physical universe doesn't become an end in and of itself. You don't measure success by physical measures. How rich you are may be important because it enables you to do something with it, but it's not important in and of itself. How strong you are, how healthy you are, how much food you eat, whatever, or don't eat, whatever it is, all those issues are important in terms of what it enables when you know yourself to be a soul. When you agree, or merely agree that you have a soul, and you believe in the idea that we also have a spiritual component, you end up living for the body, in spite of the fact that you agree, I have a soul. Yeah, when I see Michelangelo's David, I get very inspired. That must be my soul. When I go to the Grand Canyon, I get really moved. That must be my soul. Meanwhile, I've got to make it in this world, because that's really what's governing, what's driving me. So I'm talking about when a person is living in awareness that he, she is in essence a soul with a body that's a tool to get it through, there are some implications. So first of all, as we said before, you end up choosing yourself. You end up being your own creator, because now you actually welcome the challenge. Some people actually create exercises specifically to have the challenge. They say, I know, for example, I think I've mentioned this before, I know somebody, I happen to have spent a lot of time around him before I realized this. Whenever we had a meat meal, I saw that people were passing the mustard and the ketchup, whatever it is. This guy never had ketchup, mustard, or mayonnaise on his food. So one day I said to him, I've noticed that you don't have ketchup, mustard, or mayonnaise in your food. You don't like any of those? And he kind of tried to ignore me. I said, no, I really want to know what's going on here. He said, I'll talk to you later. Text me aside later and he says, I'm working on myself and I just want to train myself that I don't have to have everything that I like. Right? Now, where does that come from? He's not trying to punish himself. He's trying to master transcendence. So, just the opposite. He likes ketchup enough that would be a great game to play for him. Let me see how I could go without ketchup, just so I could say to myself, I'm eating for my health, not totally for my pleasure. That's not for everybody, but that's an example. So, you end up creating yourself when you see yourself as a soul. I'll give you another interesting quote. Who do you think said this one? Don't let Shabbos be taken from you. If your soul has no Shabbos, it becomes an orphan. Okay, nobody said that. I cheated. Albert Schweitzer said, don't let Sunday be taken from you. If your soul has no Sunday, it becomes an orphan. Okay, what is he saying? If you don't give yourself the Lord's day, then your soul is bereft. It has no connection, has nothing, right? So the point is, when you know yourself to be a soul, you're always looking for connection. And then Shabbos, for example, is not an interruption of real life. Shabbos is actually the source of real life, as an example. Prayer. Prayer becomes a natural act of communion with your source when you know yourself to be a soul. It's not something that you stop your life in order to step out of, in order to pray. Or, it's not something that you use in order to get what you need in your physical life. It's actually, you're interrupting your interruption so that you can get back into communion. Those who have mastered prayer actually experience prayer as a meal. They feel nourished when they finish davening because they actually are connected to the Almighty. And they actually plugged in. And they actually look forward to the opportunity to talk to God. It's hard. It's really hard. Why? Because we see ourselves as a body that has a soul. So we say, okay, we got to take care of the soul also. But those who know themselves to be a soul, they're actually plugging in.
So you mean humility, not...
I mean the act of prayer in any way. I don't mean necessarily Shacharis, Mincha, Maariv. I mean talking to God, asking him for things, praising him, thanking him, that kind of thing. That's what prayer is, right? And it also is the formality of prayer. Yeah. So all of that is what happens when it's... So the point is that when we see ourselves as designed for connection to God, which is what the whole point of God making us in his image, when we see it that way, then we actually start expressing ourselves to the Almighty. I'm doing this for a reason. I'm quoting outside sources. Mahatma Gandhi, you know what he said? Prayer is not asking. It's a longing of the soul. It is daily admission of one's weakness. It is better in prayer to have a heart without words than words without a heart. Right? So he has a very profound statement. And he was a guy, but a very spiritual guy. It's important for us to understand that wisdom has not eluded non-Jews. Wisdom about the human psyche and what really makes up a human being has not eluded non-Jews. They don't have Torah and mitzvos. They're not required to relate to God in that way, but they certainly can be students of the human soul. Interesting also, when a person knows himself to be a soul, he's not worried about adequacy. He's not worried about security. He's not worried about compliments. He's not worried about recognition. Because if he knows what a soul is, literally a reflection of the divine image, that's all he needs. That's really all he needs. It's only when we think that we are whatever we've accomplished, and also we have the spiritual dimension, so then we're constantly seeking for seeking recognition. Did anybody ever hear of Swami Vivekananda? He was a Hindu guru who perished in the early 1900s, who actually was one of the first one of the first to actually bring Hindu teachings to the broader world. Anyway, so he said the following: you have to grow from the inside out. None can teach you. None can make you spiritual. There is no other teacher but your own soul. And that's really true. See, we don't have to make ourselves into spiritual creatures. We are. We don't have to make ourselves connected to God. We are. What we have to do is eliminate the optical illusion, the olam, the helam, the hidden, the or, the hide, the skin, that seems to create the illusion that we're physical beings. We have to get beyond that. When we allow ourselves, through exercises, through the mitzvos, which are designed specifically to structure us so that we are constantly in touch with the Almighty, then our soul emerges. We don't have to create a soul. It's there already. That's very important for us to understand that. Okay. So once we come to the understanding that the material world is not the purpose of our existence, then we have a clearer guideline for many things in life. So let me quote you from again from the Ramchal in the Mesilas Yesharim, the Past of the Just, in chapter 1. And I'm joining him in progress, where he's talking about the fact that if we have a soul, obviously our purpose is going to be in that realm. So he says, thus we've learned that the main purpose of man's existence in this world is solely to fulfill mitzvahs, to serve God, and to withstand trials. The pleasures of this world are meant to serve only as an aid to man. It's very interesting when he says this, because he does not say the pleasures of this world are meant to be denied. As an aid to man, so that he should have peace of mind and be able to devote himself to the work that he must do. I want to get back, Jennifer, your question before about personality. This is a good place to talk about that. What makes my personality? It's exactly that, the unique merger of your physicality with your nisha, with your unique neshama, gives you a specific set of challenges and opportunities to have God known in the world in a way that no other creature can ever do or ever did do. Notice, God is multifaceted, okay? There's no limit to aspects of God that can be known. Whatever, you know, it's like if you're living inside of a huge stocking, right, or a huge sock. So you can get the sock close to a source of light and light will come in, but no matter how much light gets through with the sock, there's still more outside and there's still more to be discovered. How do you get that light in? Every human being has a unique conglomeration of physicality and spirituality, the successful merger of which will reveal a different aspect of the being of God. And when one doesn't do that, that aspect of God's essence never shows up in the world. Heavy. Every one of us is designed to bring a part of light into the world that never was here before and won't be here again. Just like our fingerprint is different, our neshama print is different. And our neshama is unique, and its merger with our particular body is unique. And together, those two entities end up creating an opportunity for God to be known in the world in a way that nobody else and no other person could ever bring into the world. So each one of us has an unbelievably powerful opportunity and a real mission. That's why Hillel says, There's another adage of Hillel. She'ein lecha adam she'ein lo sha'i. There is no man. Al tehivaz lechol adam. Do not demean any person. She'ein lecha adam she'ein lo sha'i. There is no person who does not have his time. Meaning that every single person is designed to accomplish something that cannot be accomplished by anybody else. And that's the unique merger of the neshama with the body. And I might as well go with what Chana said too. Imena nili mili. Hillel says, if I am not for myself, who is for me? What does he mean by that? He doesn't just mean, if I don't help myself, nobody else can help me. What he means is, if I'm not for myself, who is for me? Nobody else can do what I can do. If I don't do my job, no one else will ever do it. Ukshani la'atzmi ma'ani, and when I am for myself, what am I? Which means I always need divine assistance to bring God into the world. And now, this moment is the only moment that will exist like it. Which means, if I have an opportunity to say grace after meals now, and I decide to wait 5 minutes, when I do say grace after meals in 5 minutes, that'll be a different grace after meals. I didn't say better or worse. It won't be the same grace after meals that this one would have been, because this would have been a unique set of circumstances with pressure, with a baby crying, with more dessert coming, and I still, whatever, different circumstances. Every mitzvah is done in a different way, and every moment has a different... So the point is that we, if we really get the spiritual nature of a human being, we really will understand that every moment is precious, and every human being has a unique mission. And sometimes it's not through glory, it's not through headlines, it's not through recognition, it's not through being honored at the annual dinner. It's actually just through having God being known in the world through a unique combination of awareness of God at this moment that I overcame my draw not to know Him. So that's one of the implications of knowing the Almighty, of knowing that you are, in essence, a soul. Okay. The other thing is that when you get that I've said this in sermons, and I think it's an important point. When you get that you are a soul, then you get that you are designed for connection. The only part of you that's interested in anybody else is your soul. Your body, by definition, only wants its own comfort and its own well-being. And not only does it only want its own thing, it definitely sees you as a challenge to my own comfort and well-being, right? We say, and look what happens at Kiddush every week. You would think that nobody has eaten in months before. Why? Why is it? Even though we know we're going to go home and have better dessert than what we have over here. We know we're going to have better dessert in another hour. But there's a fear that somebody else will get it before me. It's an innate thing. I have it. I'm the rabbi. And nobody's going to make Kiddush before I walk in. Uh-oh. I hope they don't eat that, whatever it is, before I get to it. The point is, the body is always competing. The body is always competing. And it will never get over competition. The moment it gets over competition, it's because it yielded to the soul. The soul is a total relationship machine. It only feels good when it's connected. It's designed for connection. It's designed to love. It's designed to be part of another entity. And I'm going to quote... Boy, I'm going to tell you, get run out of town because I'm quoting Goyim right and left. But I'm doing this for a reason. I want you to know that sometimes the things are so apparent that even they get it without help from the Torah. What happened to my quotes? Here they are. Did everybody ever hear of Torquato Tasso? I'm sure you did. Torquato Tasso. He was an Italian poet. Huh?
Did he play for Pittsburgh?
He didn't play for Pittsburgh. He was a very good poet. He was a 16th century poet who, by the way, spent 7 years in an insane asylum because he really was insane. But he wrote some evocative poetry, including his most famous poem was called, in Italian, Jerusalem Conquered. I forgot how you say it in Italian. And it was about the crusader conquest of Jerusalem against the Muslims. Anyway, so he was a very, very evocative poet. So he writes, love is when he gives you a piece of your soul that you never knew was missing. I'll say it again. Love is when he gives you a piece of your soul that you never knew was missing. Right? The point is, it's amazing. The point is that that's the nature of a neshama. A neshama, by definition, longs for connection. And sometimes it doesn't even know what it's missing. But when it gets it, it's like, oh my gosh, how did I live without this? And that's literally how it's possible for a human being to love the Almighty. Because we are sourced in God. The neshama is a chelak elokam imala. It's literally a piece, which means not that God has pieces, but it's a It's of the stuff of God. As the Talmud says, when one breathes into someone else, he breathes of himself. So when God breathed the breath of life into a human being, he actually gives us his essence. And therefore, the greatest pleasure a human being can have, period, bar none, even better than winning the World Series, the greatest pleasure a human being can have, really, is total communion and connection to the Almighty. And what blocks that is the illusion that there are other pleasures that are greater than that. That's where the aura, the skin, the iver, the blindness, that's where the light is sometimes snuffed out. So our job is to find the light and to illuminate it as much as possible. Thank you for your attention, and good night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.